Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Today, we head to Rio de Janeiro for a wander through the Oscar Niemeyer-designed Sambadrome and a taste of the design that underpins the colour of the carnival.
We try to face all our troubles with joy. So I think the costumes and the samba reflects that.
Next,
Canada is where Greenpeace was founded, so it has this international reputation of pristine natural wilderness, when in fact, the way that the custodians of the environment have treated this kind of vast, vast country, it's quite surprising.
We mull over an exhibition in Montreal that exposes Canada's underreported and sometimes conflicted relationship between its nature and architecture. Plus, we saunter out of space-starved Manhattan for a tour of a Greenpoint workspace made specifically for design-minded New Yorkers. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. The Rio Carnival, held each Lent, is the world's largest and most colourful cavalcade, attracting some 2 million souls to join the procession of dancers, floats and revellers on the city's streets. One of the main attractions is the parade of samba schools, which leave from the Oscar Niemeyer-designed Sambadrome. Built in 1984 in the final years of the Brazilian dictatorship, the cold concrete structure akin to a runway abutted with terraced seating is a strangely sober-looking platform from which to launch a party. Monocle's Rio correspondent Sheena Rusto was at the Sambadrome for this year's festivities to find out how the place reflects the carioca character.
It's a last-minute sprint to the finish here at the Marques de Sapucaí, better known simply as the Sambadrome, as all of the last-minute sound checks are done to make sure the music sounds just right here for the big nights of Carnival as they parade through the Sambadrome on Sunday and Monday nights. As Carnival inches closer, all the final touches and decorations are being added here at the Sambadrome as the structure gets ready for the big parade as well, transforming from an uninspired gray strip of concrete with grandstands to a vibrant avenue, as they would like to call it. The venue itself is a uniquely built structure and is an architectural feat built by the modernist architect, the great Oscar Niemeyer, back in 1984. Before that, the samba schools would simply parade through the streets, showing off their bright costumes on top of flashy floats. But the modernist structure has managed to put these samba schools on a global stage.
The samba drum is an icon for the city. It's known worldwide, and the cariocas are really proud of it.
That's Fernanda Teixeira, a carioca carnival lover, who has both been to the Sambadrome as a spectator and has marched in the parade itself. She tells us what these samba schools and parades are all about here at the Sambadrome.
Carnival is a really big industry. It starts to prepare carnival like a year before, and it's a lot of work to get it done. It's also important to people that work, and these people are from poor communities, and it's the moment of the year where they can show themselves, when they are the stars and not marginalize it. So it's really, really important for us, and also reflects Carioca's way of living. Like, we are informal, we are happy, we make fun of things, and we love to go on, to stay on the streets and drinking and hanging out with friends, having fun. So Carnival is about all that.
For Fernanda, the annual carnival designs and the iconic architecture of the Sambadrome itself are iconic and unique to Rio's carnival period. She thinks that the bright samba design is simply a reflection of Carioca's outlook on life.
The schools, they have different themes, and each one reflect a little bit about Brazil, because they use like feathers that are very common in our indigenous culture, and so many colors that I think it reflects our joy of living. And we try to face all our troubles with joy. So I think the costumes and the samba reflects that.
Unlike other sporting venues, which tend to have a 360-degree design to give spectators different views from all angles, the long strip of pavement that is the Sambadrome for the parade is just under a kilometer long, where the city's top samba schools will find themselves parading down. Before the Oscar Niemeyer creation was complete, temporary stands would be put up and then taken down along the streets to watch the parade, which made logistics in the city rather complicated. Architect Rodrigo Dinelli explains how the design and creation of a permanent structure changed the concept of carnival. When the concept of the Sambadrome first came to be, says Rodrigo, many people felt it wouldn't be ready in time for carnival. The mayor wanted to build it, he says, but there was just over 100 days until the parade. So Oscar Niemeyer said, "We built Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, in 4 years. So why can't we build the Sambadrome in 4 months?" And so the Sambadrome was born, explains Rodrigo. He tells me that the Sambadrome started to allow people to watch the parades close up with more comfort. The idea of comfort at the Sambadrome is an added element to be explored while watching the biggest carnival celebration in the world. The Sambadrome was certainly designed with more comfort than just sitting in the grandstands. Niemeyer put in several camarotes, or VIP boxes, in the center of the Sambadrome so more VIP guests can enjoy the parade while watching the parade with all the comforts of a club, spa, and restaurant all mixed into one. In total, there are about 10 large VIP boxes and 20 small ones. The idea of these VIP boxes at the Sambadrome has grown over the years, and now each box has its own theme and design to go along with the experience. Rodrigo Dinelli is showing me around the camarote that he's designed, called Folia Tropical, tropical merrymaking in English. He tells me that this year's theme for the three-floor VIP box is the Amazon rainforest. And the space here doesn't lack comfort. It comes fully equipped with a private elevator used for guests only, a dance floor, restaurant, and bar, along with stations where guests can get a foot rub or even try out new cosmetics. He says that the theme is an important one, as he wants to show how important the preservation of the world's largest rainforest is, and one that is progressively disappearing. Last-minute preparations are fully underway at Folia Tropical, as leafy green decorations made of sustainable materials are pinned and sewed up.
O Folia Tropical existe há 5 anos. O primeiro foi um protótipo.
In the rush to get everything ready on time, I meet Agnes Mendoza, the owner of the VIP box Folia Tropical, and she's getting her hands dirty during the preparations. She tells me that the point of having this VIP box, which she's owned and run for the past 5 years, is to add extra value to Brazilian culture through the atmosphere that's created through the design. This is a Brazilian celebration, after all, she says. From the costume designs that the thousands of performers wear, to the tropically designed VIP boxes, to the Sambadrome structure itself, Brazilian design is well worked into the country's carnival culture, showing that this world-famous parade showcases to the world more than just Brazilians having a good time. It shows off the modernist architecture and tropical designs that the South American nation has mastered through years of carnival. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Canada's 150th birthday this summer comes at a curiously positive time for the North American nation. Many see it as one of the last few bastions of liberal cosmopolitanism in a world lurching towards populism. Another trope of Canadian nationhood is a love of the outdoors and a careful custodianship of nature. It's an idea, however, that's being challenged in an exhibition at the Canadian Centre for Architecture in Montreal. The exhibition looks at how the relationship between Canadians and their environment is a little more fraught than many realise. James Taylor Foster is the editor-at-large of architecture website Arc Daily, and he joined this show's producer Henry Rhys Sheridan in studio to give his take on the Canadian Centre for Architecture's latest exhibition.
The CCA, the Canadian Centre of Architecture, is an institute, a private institution in Montreal. Montreal is a wonderful, wonderful place, of course, but it is peripheral in many ways. I wouldn't say it's off the beaten track, but it's adjacent to the beaten track. And it's a very interesting place for a major international architecture centre to be founded. It was founded by a woman called Phyllis Lambert, who really has been a really bulwark in the kind of architectural scene now she's 90 now, for many, many years. She has put together one of the greatest collection of architectural drawings and books and objects in the world, in Montreal, and around it built a fascinating institute which is constantly kind of churning out wonderful exhibitions and books. And this is the latest, this exhibition they've put out is the latest in that kind of string. It's called It's All Happening So Fast, A Counter-History of the Modern Canadian Environment. And really, you know, as a kind of precursor to the 150th anniversary of Canada's Confederation, it's trying to say, look, amid all these national celebrations, let's have a dose of reality and try and dispel some myths about the Canadian environment. I mean, when we think of Canada, what comes to your mind when you think of Canada?
Yeah, I suppose all the stereotypes, in particular in relation to the natural environment,
exactly.
Very bucolic settings, and also, more constructive sense of custodianship on the part of the population towards the environment than perhaps in other countries.
Precisely. And I think that's exactly the kind of impetus they had for this exhibition and said, look, if we actually dissect this, what has been going on and what is going on? Obviously, Canada is where Greenpeace was founded. So it has this international reputation for, as you say, a very bucolic environment of pristine natural wilderness, when in fact it has been fracked to death, when in fact the kind of pollutants which have been pushed into the atmosphere have been astonishing. When you look at the way that actually the custodians of the environment have treated this kind of vast, vast country, you know, it's really one of the largest countries in the world and actually one of the least populated. It's quite surprising. So this exhibition pulls together all of these themes. It pulls together moments in which, for example, the government tried to address the environment and maybe failed, but it also pulls together some of the instances where really some devastating moves were made, which we're still suffering from.
We can maybe talk in a little bit more detail about some of the flashpoints in that dynamic. But why is an architecture centre bringing this to attention? What does it have to do with architecture?
This is the interesting thing. They've tried to pull together the conditions in which buildings have contributed to this, right? So we have situations of chimneys. There was a case of a chimney which was built extremely high to try and disperse pollution far, far away from the ground. What it actually did was create a pollution cloud bigger than the world has ever seen, okay? And it has been damaging the environment for many years, and it was shut down. We look at instances where architects such as Ralph Erskine were designing really like homes which would be extremely environmentally friendly, or cities for the Arctic, which might start to allow people to inhabit this kind of area in ways which were impossible at the time, many of which failed, but attempts. Okay, so it's looking through an architectural lens at this, which is an interesting way, because if you don't look at it through a kind of thematic eye, I think you start to get lost in the theme.
And the history of the Canadian population's exploitation of their natural environment also intersects with the population of European descent's exploitations of the indigenous peoples.
Yeah, precisely. If we really try to bring it down to kind of five themes we're looking at, this exhibition is trying to dispel cultural myths. It's trying to also examine this evolving legal context in relation to the environment, which Canada has developed over the last 100 years. The changing ideas of environmental risk, the impact of the environmentalist movement, which, as I kind of mentioned, was born in Canada, one could argue, but also resurgent indigenous peoples who, as communities, have started to fight back against the government in many respects and are now in quite interesting, powerful positions. We're starting to see a really interesting balance, actually, between the indigenous populations and the urban centres.
And just to clarify, is the fact that the environment has been polluted or destroyed an important component of the grievance of these resurgent indigenous populations.
Yes, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Especially because, you know, like I said, Canada's so sparsely populated and really concentrated in a number of large metropolises, often close to the US border. We see vast expanses of wilderness which have been really destroyed without contempt. And these have been historically, places where indigenous communities have thrived. So this is the kind of argument which is now starting to, as I said, redress the balance. But this exhibition is trying to say, look, even though there's positive moves happening, there's still extremely damaging things happening. Oil pipelines, for example, as we've seen recently in the news. And actually, in amidst all this kind of celebration about what Canada is, let's just try and just think about what's actually going on. And this is unique because I don't think we haven't seen anything quite like this yet in Canada. I think they're fairly unique.
It strikes me that architects like to be sustainable and like to address questions of sustainability, but they like to do it in a way which is sexy. So they like to build a sustainable house, which looks beautiful and which they can sell to rich people. First of all, would it be more effective for architects who want to be sustainable to put their energy into, for example, designing energy infrastructure, factory buildings, the structures that contribute such an outsized amount of CO2 emissions into the Earth environment? Should they put their energies into making them better? Is my first question. Mm. And my second question is, do you think that there is a will to do that within the architectural community?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a will to do that. I think the issue is that it's not simply about taking a typology, such as a factory, and saying, let's make this better. Because really, the architect, nowadays anyway, the architect's skill is really in how people move around space, occupation. Okay, so what I think is needed when it comes to this sort of question that you pose is a more interdisciplinary approach with the people who can really make things more efficient in a technical sense. You don't see the greatest architects in the world designing factories. The one instance I can think of is the Danish architect Bjarke Ingels designing a power station.
With a ski slope on top.
With a ski slope, yeah, that actually puffs out donut smoke rings.
As is his wont.
As is his wont. And I mean, fair enough. But what it shows is he is completely preoccupied by, one, how people move about it, and two, how it looks. It also lights up. You know, I mean, really, I'm not entirely sure. Maybe, you know, I'm completely wrong in this, but I'm not entirely sure how much of involvement he's had in the technical workings of the factory, of the power station, aside from the smoke ring mechanism. So while he's should be applauded for kind of making a step towards it, he hasn't gone as far as he could have done. And I think this is the wider discussion because, you know, like I said, architecture is really, it's quite a trendy thing. It's also trendy within the profession. Architects look to other architects to see where things are moving, and then we all sort of move in a kind of chaos towards an objective. If architects were to see, I hate the word, but purported starchitects engage with typologies which they might not usually engage with,
they can set a trend.
They can set a trend.
Yeah.
So maybe this is what needs to happen. But at the same time, we also mustn't forget there are a large group of architects who are designing factories. I mean, they may not be the most internationally acclaimed, but, you know, someone's making them, and it'd be remiss to suggest that they're not doing it consciously and ethically.
James Taylor Foster there, editor-at-large of architecture website Arc Daily. The exhibition in question, entitled It's All Happening So Fast, runs at the Canadian Centre for Architecture in Montreal until April the 9th. Still to come on the show, we're going to Greenpoint for a tour around a new co-working space that's aimed specifically at design-minded New Yorkers.
Back in February 2007, 10 long years ago, the very first edition of Monocle magazine hit newsstands. A lot has happened in the decades since. From that first office in London's Boston Place to 7 fully staffed bureaux around the world. From the humble beginnings of issue 1 to a media brand and business producing beautiful books, magazines, and 24/7 radio and podcasts, to a chain of Monocle shops selling original ranges and collaborations with our favourite brands, to Monocle films, events, and sellout annual conferences. Yes, a lot has happened, and the next chapters aren't written yet. Happy birthday, Monocle, and here's to the next 10 years.
No sooner has a neighbourhood blossomed than another blooms, and New Yorkers, dismayed by high rents in space-starved Manhattan, have trickled to Brooklyn in steadily greater numbers. Now, BMW subsidiary Mini, a brand that knows a thing or two about small spaces, has enlisted the help of New York-based N Architects to design a co-working space with designers in mind. The project is called ADO. Monocle 24 contributor Megan Billings hopped across the East River for a quick tour.
I'm Nate Pensley, the managing director of ADO.
Daniel Pittman, the design director of ADO.
We're in your space. It's still a work in progress. So tell me where I'm standing and what this will be when everything's finished.
Sure. You're standing in the heart of ADO, which is between our public entrance, which invites people off the street to come and be part of our program and enjoy our restaurant and come and work on a first-come, first-served basis in our communal working space, but also our private space. So we have workspace that's available for rent to designers. We have an accelerator that invests in startup design and hardware companies. And that really reflects our overall program, which is both a public cultural institution engaging a really broad section of the population in a conversation about design, but also sort of a research institution that invites prominent thinkers and kind of insiders to come and debate and interrogate the role that design will play in shaping the future, trying to cover new frontiers in what the design world is going to look at for 5 and 10 years into the future.
So since we're here in the public space, so there's a communal working space and there's also a restaurant as well. Tell me exactly the purpose in your mind of engaging the outside world and how you kind of aim to do that, how you'll kind of get people in here.
Sure. So we created the ADO for two reasons, right? One is because we saw a need in the community. While there's a vibrant design community in New York City, it's very siloed. So there's pockets of architects and pockets of graphic designers, and there's students at schools, and then there's professionals in their practices, but there aren't as many places of exchange where many different people at different stages of their design career and from different disciplines can come into one place and convene without needing to have a membership or without having to go through a bunch of barriers to join in a conversation together. So that was the need that we saw. And from the perspective of Mini, the auto company which founded this and is the parent of all of our work, we wanted to create a space that hosts a conversation about design and where design will go into the future, because we as a design company are interested in that. It's relevant to the future of our company and where we want to take our innovation and our manufacturing in order to provide benefits for urban living for years and years to come.
And was there kind of a particular reason why you chose to be in Greenpoint?
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's many quote-unquote creative capitals of the world that we looked at when we wanted to start this out. We pretty quickly centered on New York, not least of which because I'm personally from Brooklyn, so it made it very convenient. But specifically Brooklyn and specifically Greenpoint, because it is a unique cross-section of design. So there's over 300 artists and design studios just within the immediate vicinity here in Greenpoint, but also manufacturing. There's not that many neighborhoods in creative capitals around the world that still have fabricators and light manufacturing within a several block radius of restaurants and a design community. So that sort of opportunity for a multi-use space where we can have a restaurant and have events, but also have fabrication tools, 3D printers, CNC routers, all that stuff, all in one house, and access to that network in the local community, it makes Greenpoint and Brooklyn a very unique place.
So tell me exactly what it is that you're going to be doing here.
Yes, so as Nate alluded to, we have a physical space with a lot of complementary activities and infrastructure. So food, retail, accelerator, incubator. But alongside that, we are curating a layer of content and inviting people to participate in formulating and interrogating that content. The role of the Design Academy is to shepherd that piece along. So the way in which we show up is, first of all, framing ideas that will kind of frame the year as it unfolds. Every 4 months, a new theme, a new idea to investigate and discuss. We will also pose the initial questions or prompts, why we think it's interesting, or suggesting what could be explored, the intent of which is to really provide inspiration and kind of service the kind of broader world of designers and basically ask the question of what's the role of designers, where could it be, what can we do, what is the potential for impact. I wanted to return to something discussed in terms of the audience, the people that we're inviting, because as Nate suggested, there is an idea that design is we see it as a very broad category, whether that's graphic or fashion, whatever, and that there's value to be had in the cross-pollination of those different disciplines. But just as important is how design interacts with the broader world. So inviting the sociologist or the policymaker or the teacher to participate in conversation. And I think that larger cross-pollination and the idea that this place can serve to enable serendipity, perhaps, is the kind of intent for the programming, that how can we lay out a feast that will engender that. Now, what the programming actually is a whole layer of multiple different things. And we have dedicated spaces that serve that, but also the intention to use the free space and really mix and interact with what's going on an everyday basis. So where we are now is one of the classrooms. We have three spaces that are available for workshops, for kind of smaller events, private dining. But in the first instance, we will have a designer in residence here. So for the course of the next 4 months, Stephen Burks, the furniture designer, will set up his studio in the space. And together with ADO and the broader community of people that we're inviting into this space, will investigate and conceive of a new line of furniture. And the idea is that we put on display the process of actually getting to a manufactured product and being able to show every aspect and constraint that a designer confronts in the real world. So we have that alongside, in the outside space, an exhibition that highlights ideas and issues surrounding our initial theme, utopia versus dystopia. We also have in the outside space installation by the design collective, the UK-based design collective Assemble. They will be building a workshop in the outside courtyard that will effectively be a factory for ceramics, and in their own process, looking at the kind of the scale that you move from kind of handcraft and cottage industry to manufacturing, and how those differing technologies, skills, and processes affect the ability of designers to engage in their work. Also outside is a landscape architecture firm that will be designing a number of garden spaces that also reflect utopia versus dystopia, but hopefully create a little bit of an oasis.
Megan Billings there, reporting from the ADO Collaborative Workspace in Brooklyn's Greenpoint. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer, Henry Reese Sheridan. Also, the man behind the glass today is Wei Dong Lin. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the self-same time next week. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes, and do feel free to leave us an extremely positive review on the latter. It really does help people find the show. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much and goodbye.